What's it like when one of your friends on death row is led away to be executed?
You have a prepaid call from
William A. Alguero,
an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I had to be a different complete guy, which is the guy who walked ways of San Quentin death row and without a gang, without a group of people around me. It was just me.
Soon after you went into to be on death row, and you didn't really understand the prison workout system so much, but then he said, we're going to do 75 sets of it. To me, that seems extreme. So I'm wondering if there's a danger of overtraining, wearing yourself out so that you're...
No, that's actually funny. That's funny, and it's funny, and I'll tell you why. That's a good one, man. I'll tell you why.
Welcome to Death Row Diaries. I'm Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nogueira.
And we got to apologize to our listeners because this episode's coming out a little later than usual. And that's because we had a little storm, or a big storm, depending on what kind of news you watch. But a storm nonetheless. And it affected parts of Northern and Central California, such as where you're at, and your phones went down, so we couldn't record, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The system is put together with toothpicks and bubble gum, and it screwed up. And actually, this morning, it's screwing up, too, so hopefully we can do the whole episode before the bubble gum comes unraveled and it goes out of service.
Yeah, this is just cow country. All of California is still basically just cow country. And I am concerned because, I mean, did you have snow or strong winds or anything like that?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, there was a little bit of rain, but I mean, I wouldn't call it a storm. It's just, the system sucks. It's just horrible. The state of California paid millions of dollars for this GTL via path system. It really just sucks. I mean, as of 6 o'clock in the evening, the system goes completely haywire. And no matter who you're talking to, it sounds like they're underwater. So it's just, look, they're making a lot of money from the government, GTL, ViaPath, and they're collecting their money. They got paid up front, so they don't care what the system looks like, and that's the results that we have.
Yeah, and all these libertarian guys talking about, the commerce and the free market, like you just said, they're getting paid up front. They have no incentive to do a good job, and it's all just handshake deals and it's a bunch of bullshit. Anyway, please make sure and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Death Row Diaries and on Patreon at Death Row Diaries, where you'll get bonus episodes that aren't otherwise available. I just dropped one earlier this week, and it was something that a listener requested that we cover, and it was a really enlightening episode, and I would encourage everyone to check that out. It was about the Sacramento vampire, so that was some pretty crazy stuff. Anyway, Bill, on to today's episode, and we got some bad news. You got some bad news regarding what the California Supreme Court has been up to. So, assuming that we have first-time listeners, can you just give us kind of a brief synopsis of what's going on and how they ruled and what went on before we get a little deeper into it?
Sure. So obviously most of our listeners know that I spent nearly 40 years on California's death row at San Quentin Prison. I was convicted of a killing in 1983, and I spent the rest of the next four decades on death row. That changed in 2017 when a federal judge, a federal court, reversed my conviction and my sentence, threw everything out, called it a miscarriage of justice, and ordered that I be retried or released in 120 days. So that being said, the Attorney General in California did what he said he wouldn't do, which was to appeal when judges hand out reversals for whatever errors took place during the trial or unfairness or travesties of justice. Well, he did the opposite. He appealed it, and it went up to the Ninth Circuit, which took about 5 more years of my life. And then, of course, a Trump judge reversed my conviction again, taking away my reversal, taking away my chance to get out, and basically gave me life in prison. And that's where I find myself now, which is at Corcoran Prison. I have been moved out of San Quentin's death row, and basically the wheels of justice turned, I guess, slightly, and I'm waiting for the results of that particular decision. In the meantime, back in 2017, my attorneys and I filed a motion in the California Supreme Court, which basically said there are laws in California that state that anyone under the age of, at that time, 23 years of age, is considered a youth offender. And the laws in California say that if you're a youth offender and you've committed, say, a murder or two or whatever, or you've done a million burglaries and they gave you 1,000 years to life, that even with that sentence, after 25 years straight in prison, which is still a lifetime, you are eligible for parole. Now, that does not mean that you're going to get out. That just means that you're eligible to go before a board of parole experts who will sit there and ask you questions about insight, rehabilitation, your education, what you've done, how you've changed, what you're doing for society, how does society benefit from you being out. And if they deem that you are an appropriate candidate for parole, then they give the case to the governor of California, who has ultimate ruling on whether you get out or not. Okay. That being established, I filed a lawsuit basically saying, well, what about me? I'm a youth offender. I was only 18 years of age when this happened. I have a homicide on one person. It was my first felony conviction. Never had anything else before this, and nothing after. And yet they gave me the death penalty. I'm a youth offender. Now that I've been given life, I would like to be treated like other youth offenders under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, which basically says that anybody similarly situated must be treated equally. The California Supreme Court came back to me in 2017 and said, we don't have jurisdiction because you just got a full reversal from a federal court stating that you should be released. Well, I didn't fight it then because I figured, well, the wheels of justice will turn in my way. I'm going to get out. Well, here I am. So another individual by the name of Hardin, H-A-R-D-I-N, filed. And he filed in the lower courts, and he won unanimous decisions all the way up to the Supreme Court because the Attorney General in California kept appealing it. Hardin kept winning. This clown kept appealing. Well, when it got to the California Supreme Court, and now it is relevant to me, so my case is attached to it, the California Supreme Court ruled on Monday that youth offenders, although they're all the same, they're actually not the same, because if you have life without possibility of parole, you are not similarly situated, and therefore you are not going to get a parole hearing after 25 years. Which is ridiculous. The law is based on brain development, and therefore, by brain development, a person under the age of 23 are all similarly situated. California Supreme Court did not agree and basically screwed me and probably, I don't know, 10,000 other kids that were arrested when they were teenagers.
Yeah, and this has been, as you just explained, developing for quite some time. This whole concept of 18 to 25 is
you have 60 seconds remaining.
Is a known talking point in terms of this issue, right?
Well, yeah. Look, the truth is, I don't think like I did when I was 18 years of age. I was a child. Now, I believe there should be a difference between an 18-year-old and a 25-year-old. Like if a guy commits a crime at 25, he's more culpable than I was at 18. So it bothers me. This angers me. And let me call you back. I hope that this phone won't screw up so I can call you back so we can finish this. But, yeah, I'm a little upset. I'm not going to lie to you. Hey, man.
Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong. The Harden decision, the eventual decision, was that kind of unexpected? And so that gave you some confidence and some hope that you would get a chance at parole. And so you must have been looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. The reason I was hopeful was because the actual argument that this SB 261, 260, 1308, which are all the statutes and provisions that the legislation put in place recognizing that youth offenders are to be treated differently than fully adult people, that was a concept that I came up with when I filed first in the California Supreme Court. I thought it out very well. I analyzed that equal protection of the law means exactly that, equal protection of the law. And when it deals with something like brain development, and the law itself is based on brain development, and a person under the age of 25 all have this certain issue regarding development or underdevelopment of the brain, we should all be treated equally. We are not, because definitely this gives a lot of power to whoever's prosecuting the case. So if a prosecutor decides to go after a kid for political reasons, he doesn't like the color of his skin, he doesn't like the way he looks, whatever it may be, he can go after him with a special circumstance, and if he's convicted and gets life without possibility of parole, that youth offender is basically screwed. So it's really on the whim of who's prosecuting the case, and that bothers me. Look, when I first was arrested, people were definitely questioning as to why I was prosecuted as if I were a serial killer or a person that killed 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 people. You know, taking the life of one person is horrible. There is no denying that. And I accept full responsibility for my actions. And I believe in fairness. I believe that a person who commits a crime should pay a penalty. But that penalty should be fair and based on established perimeters. When the 1978 law, which was Proposition 7, the California voters voted for the death penalty and life without possibility of parole, they were sold that argument that the people that would receive these ultimate sentences would be the most heinous, the most terrible, the persons that were irreparable, people like serial killers, serial rapists, child molesters, child killers, people who have killed multiple people, hitmen, people of that sort. What the taxpayer actually got was convictions of children, kids 18, 19 years old, and people who were poor, that didn't have the means to go up against a full prosecution that had unlimited resources, meaning the police department and everything else. And look, I'm all about the truth and the justice and how law enforcement works. I have no problem with that. But I want to be treated fairly. I have been in prison since I was a crime I was 18 years old. There has to be a difference between an 18 and, say, 25-year-old or a person barely or just about to turn 26. I know that I thought differently and my brain processed things differently at the age of 25 as opposed to when I was an 18-year-old boy and this crime was committed. The proof of that is the person that was convicted with me, they went home 36 years ago. They were months earlier, younger than I was. They were a juvenile, and I, in fact, was an 18-year-old, so considered an adult. I couldn't drink legally, but I sure could suck gas and be executed for that, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, that was a woman also, so there's an issue there. But so there, not just you, but there are thousands of people, prisoners, who were watching this, or at least aware of it and had pending cases, appeals, things like this, that, you know, are probably going to be fairly devastated now, I would guess. So how do you think they're going to cope with this, and are they going to hold up and continue rehabilitating themselves, or do you think there might be a certain dejection that happens now collectively?
Well, they were devastated. Yeah, I can tell you a lot of these guys were devastated. I know of a number of guys who have rehabilitated themselves. They have gone to school, they've gotten educated, they've understood and gained insight and really appreciated, took complete responsibility for their crimes, because there was hope. There was a second chance for them. And they've done all these things. And on Tuesday, which was the day after the decision, I went outside and I ran across a couple of these guys that I had known had gone down to level twos, and they were previously at level fours. They were involved in gangs. They were very aggressive. Well, they were criminals. And for the past several decades, they've rehabilitated themselves to be better people. And when I asked them, hey, what are you doing out here? You're normally at work, or you're normally at school. There was a pause, and they looked at me and they said, you know, I changed my whole life, and I sacrificed being looked upon with respect in prison, which is where I live and the environment and the culture I live in, because I had a hope to get a second chance. Anyway, and they said this very eloquently, which I was taken aback from, and they said, but now I have no chance. They've taken everything from me. I've worked hard, and I know what I'm feeling is wrong, because I should, and I am rehabilitated, and I do understand things, but I'm angry. And you know what? I don't feel like going to school. I don't feel like going back to work. And they left it at that. But I couldn't help but understand their anger. And some of these kids who have spent the last 20, 30 years trying to do better feel like they've been handed a raw deal, that they're not being treated fairly, and a lot of them are going to turn to violence. It's unfortunate, but you know, in prison is not like living in society where you can be rehabilitated, go out there, get a family, a job, and things will go right. And yeah, you're going to have bumps around the on the road, but they're not completely where you're shut out of everything. So the person can rebound, get back up, and continue working hard towards their goals. This ruling just decapitated all their hopes and cut them off at the knees. So for those people who are going to say, aha, you see, they weren't rehabilitated because now they're going to turn to violence. Well, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. These kids that were waiting for the decision spent 25, 30 years trying to be better, and now they have nothing. And I can understand their anger. And I understand some of them, not all of them. I'm certainly not going to go down that path. I'm going to continue doing what I do to educate the public and do what we do here on Death Row Diaries. And I'm going to continue working on these cases and doing the things that, because it's who I am. It doesn't matter what they do against me. I'm going to continue on this path. But there are others that are not going to be able to. They're going to be so devastated that they respond differently. And some of them will respond with, you know, possibly violence. And they probably will be less likely to walk away from the situation. I'm not saying they're going to pick up a gun and start running around trying to kill people. What I'm trying to say is that most of the time, these guys, when confronted with a violent situation, they lower their head and walk away because they know the consequences. And they know that they don't want to be involved in that stuff because they're expecting a good outcome. But now, when someone confronts them, someone pushes them, someone takes a swing at them, they're probably not going to lower their eye and walk away. They're probably going to engage the person, and that's not going to be good for anybody.
Yeah. So Harden, the guy who eventually, you know, won his appeal and was now struck down, you weren't familiar with that guy personally, were you?
No, I didn't know Harden personally. I knew the case very well. But he's different than I am. And let me just state this in the clearest terms that I can. Harden was actually 25 years of age when he committed his crime. at 25 years of age, I was 18. And although the law looks at us similarly because we're youth offenders, and the normal law looks at us as adults, there has to be a different set of circumstances on how to judge somebody. And let me explain. So if you're 9 years old, you're a juvenile. And if you're 17 years old, 363 days, you're still a juvenile. But if that 17-year-old with 363 days and 24 hours or 23 hours commits 5 murders, he will be charged as an adult. He cannot get the death penalty, and he cannot receive life without possibility of parole, but he can get 100 to 200 years in life in prison and do 25 years straight before he's eligible. However, if that 9-year-old commits a crime of that nature, he will not be charged as an adult. He'll be charged as a juvenile. So, Mike, what I'm trying to explain is that because I was 18 and not 25, which is the limit of that law, there should be a bit of a difference between that 18-year-old and that 25-year-old and how the law looks at them, because they are different. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but were you the same guy at 25 as you were when you were 18?
No, not at all. I mean, when I was 18, I didn't even understand how the country worked. I don't think I'd really read a newspaper. I don't think I didn't really care about anything except basketball, girls, and parties, you know. And I mean, I went to school and everything. I wasn't mentally deficient, but I was emotionally completely undeveloped.
And that's what I'm looking for, the word maturity. An 18-year-old and a 25-year-old, the difference to them is maturity. It is not so much whether they're youth offenders or they're in one category. The key is maturity. And I can tell you with a medical certainty that at 18 years old, I thought of the same things. Girls, cars, partying, and just stupid things that went through my brain. So stupid that when confronted with the situation, I result in violence. And that led to my situation here and the loss of human life. At 25 years of age, had that same situation rose, I would have handled it different because I had more control of my emotions and my impulses. So I have a big problem with that. I think that the key to this is what we just said right now, is maturity. And I'm going to be speaking to my attorneys and maybe addressing the issue of maturity at 18 as opposed to the level of understanding and maturity at 25, and trying to get the court to take a look at that case through maturity, which gives me a little bit of hope. But nevertheless, I don't think you or the audience has to fear that I'm going to suddenly change from the person that I am. Who you hear speak on these programs, who you hear and whose books you read about and the things that I do is who I am. There is nothing in this world that's going to make me change into a different person because of a decision of some whack job judges that couldn't distinguish their a hole in the ground from their ass.
So is that your plan, is to really drill down and focus on, you know, to consult your lawyers and construct an argument regarding what we've just been talking about, like a more specific argument than just the Harden thing, the 18 to 25, but more of a 18 to 19 or 20 type thing? You can answer when you get back.
Absolutely. Yeah, let me call you right back. I'm definitely going to be consulting with the team of lawyers that I have regarding this issue. It may be something that we even file on the federal level, but I don't know yet, because if it is federal, and it's a constitutional issue, it would have to be exhausted in the state level first, so I might have to do some more filing in this case. But I don't know yet. I'm basically speaking out of emotion right now. This is very upsetting. It's something that, you know, my mother was hoping for, although she didn't understand the complexities of this. You have to understand, my mother's in her mid-80s now, and I took away her only son when she was, well, she was only 43, 44 years of age. I've been incarcerated now for 41 years, and my mother lost her son because of my actions. I'm her only son. So I have not told my mother, and, you know, it's devastating because I really wanted to spend some time with her. She, every time I speak to her, she asks when I'll be coming home. It's the same questions my father asked before he passed away, and I didn't have an answer for my father. And it's one of those things that this is when you really understand the impact of your actions, which this is no way I could have understood this when I was younger, because, you know, mortality was not something an 18-year-old processes. But when you see your father pass away with from Alzheimer's, your mother on her last few days, and they ask you those questions, when are you coming home, son? It really does hit you square in the forehead, because you understand that your crime was not about just you and about the direct victim, which is very important if there's a person who lost their life, but it also affects their family, their friends, the community, the secondary victims, and not to be forgotten, the victims of your actions are also your parents, your sisters, your family. You know, I put my parents through a lot of anguish and embarrassment when people would tell them or ask them, "Well, your son's in prison. Isn't your son a killer?" And, you know, in my family, I have nobody in my family has ever been convicted of a felony, much less sent to prison. In my extended family, the same thing goes for them. So you can imagine the scarlet letter that my parents wore on their chest because of my actions. So all these things play a big part on who I am today, because I actually understand how much damage my actions and the consequences of those actions have caused.
Yeah, and I'm sure the listeners understand, but in case anyone is a little confused, because it can get a little complex, you know, you weren't looking to be immediately released. You were just looking for a chance at parole. Now, I think if you got a parole date, I would bet a lot of money that you would be granted that, right? But all these people were just looking for a chance at parole, not an immediate release or something like that, not some kind of amnesty.
Exactly. This does not by any way, shape, or form sign your papers for release. The only thing I was looking forward to is going before a parole board with the eligibility to be heard. That's it. This doesn't mean you're getting out. This doesn't mean anything like that. This would have meant that at a certain prescribed time, after 25 years straight, which in my case, I've already been in prison for 41 years, it would have allowed me to go before a group of professional parole committees, and they would have looked at my insight, my rehabilitation, my education, and all the factors, mitigating and aggravating, and made a determination on whether I met the criteria for rehabilitation and was I eligible for parole. If their answer would have been yes, again, it doesn't mean anything. I'm not getting out. All it means is then the case is sent to the governor's office, and he can rule on it, not rule on it, ignore it. California has a very tricky parole system for someone who has a life top. And that parole system basically says that not only do you have to get the parole board to say you're fit to be released, but the governor himself must say that he agrees with it. Otherwise, you're not getting out. So of all the youth offenders in California, 97% of them were not going to get out anyways, no matter what, because they have not embraced rehabilitation. They have not accepted responsibility for their crimes and have changed and done a substantial amount of work. And I'm not talking about years, 6 months. I'm talking about decades of work in prison in order to become the person that society can say he would be an asset to us. And that is one of the questions they ask. How will society benefit from you being out here with us? And does it outweigh what you did in the past? That's a huge hurdle, and most people won't get over it. But that's kind of the long answer. So the short answer is, no, you're not going to get out. This law would not have anybody out. It would just give the eligibility to go before a parole board, and that's it.
Do you think these judges, now obviously judges are independent, they're not necessarily beholden to anyone, and it depends on the judge, but the climate that we have right now culturally, you know, San Francisco is kind of a mess. People are pissed about Gascon, the DA of LA, and you know, the media is just feeding this thing about how California is going to hell and all this stuff, and it's an election year. It's election season. You know, with all these things, do you think the judges are influenced to kind of think like, we don't want to appear soft on this or whatever? Or do you think that that has nothing to do with it?
Well, they're human, so I imagine that the climate does have something to do with it. I believe that they're absolutely wrong. I think their decision was incorrect. And look, I'm not a judge, but I spent probably more time in the legal system and legal libraries than most of those judges. You know, I'm 60 years old. I've spent 41 years in libraries reading everything I get my hands on. Their decision is unfounded. It's incorrect. And I stand by that. That being said, most judges don't understand the prison system. They know one side of the legal argument or the part of justice. They don't understand the legal system. And that is fiscal responsibility as well. And what I mean by that is that you have a lot of politicians now that are arguing with Gascon and, well, he's too soft on crime and all this other stuff. I beg to differ. Gascon, what he's had the ability to do is look at both sides of both the justice system and the incarcerated. And what that means is that Gascon understands that, for example, the death penalty. It's a joke. Since 1967, you've had 13 people executed. The rest of the people that have been sentenced to death, is over 2,000 people, they're not going to get executed. Okay? The legal system, the bought downs, there's not enough attorneys. They're not. So the system is broken. It doesn't work. Life without possibility of parole, what it does is it overburdens the taxpayer, and that's the fiscal responsibility. Nowadays, if a person has two strikes, you know, let's say he had a felony when he was 18 years old, he stole a tire. At 24, he gets in a fight with somebody, and he picks up an assault because he beat the guy. Or it was a mutual fight, but he won the fight. And then at, let's say, 30 years of age, he's down on his luck and he steals a loaf of bread. That's his third strike. That guy automatically gets 25 years to life for a loaf of bread. So let's look at the fiscal responsibility of that loaf of bread. That loaf of bread costs $5 in the most expensive freaking store in California. But yet now, for that $5 loaf of bread, the California taxpayer is going to pay $107,000 a year to keep that guy in prison for 25 years straight. That is the part that Gascon understands, and most people who vote don't, because they're busy. They have their fathers, their mothers, their grandparents. They are workers. They're working every day. They expect the person that they put in office to relate these messages to them because they vote these people in. Unfortunately, the people that are voted into office don't give a damn about that. They're going to use that trampoline to say, I'm hard on crime, I'm going to do this, we're going to put everybody away. Look what the country is in terms of the legal system now. When we've had Ronald Reagan, we've had Donald Trump, we've had the Bushes in there, the most conservative people, they were handing out 100-year sentences for an ounce of weed or half an ounce of weed. Where has that led us? We have over 2.3 million people in prisons And you know what? Here's a secret for you, Matt. Crime pays. It just doesn't pay the criminal. It pays judges. It pays law enforcement. It pays correctional officers. It pays the medical staff. It pays the builders of prisons. It is a big market to make money. And the cows in that market are the inmates. That's why the system is the way it is. And the taxpayer, unfortunately, is paying for it.
Well, Bill, I would just like to say that I'm very sorry that it didn't work out this time. And I'm hoping that, you know, there is a path that you'll be able to figure it out. I'm truly very sorry for you, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. And, you know, we'll be thinking of you, I'm just sorry it's another disappointment.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and no worries. I'm not going to turn into a monster overnight. I'm just going to figure out different ways on how to hopefully win my freedom someday. But that being said, I appreciate the time, and I hope the listeners are having a good day, and that they've kind of heard what I've said about the whole system and how it works.
Yeah, thank you for that. Check us out on Patreon, and check out Bill's newsletter. You can sign up for that. Until next time, I've been Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nogueira. Be safe. Be aware of your surroundings. Your life could depend on it. And my website now is williamnogueira.com. Okay. All right, Matt. Take care, buddy. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Have a good one.